Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time's 2 minutes after 1 p.m., Monday, March 26, 2012. With me today is Senator Ellis, Senator Egan, Senator Thomas. We'll be joined by some other committee members here shortly. Myself, Stedman, this afternoon we have one bill on the agenda, Senate Bill 80 by Senator Menard regarding the Kinnickahn Bridge and Toll Authority. This is the first hearing on this bill. We've been joined by Senator Olson. The intent today is to adopt a committee substitute, have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside for further review. And if we could have a motion, Senator Thomas, for adoption of committee substitute version T.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill number 80 for the purposes of review and
version T.
Version backslash T, correct.
We have and I'll object for explanation and ask Senator Menard to come forward, please. She could introduce herself for the record, who she represents, and then explain the changes to the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, I would allow me, please, to put on the record that my name is Senator Linda Menard. I represent District G, the Greater Palmer and Wasilla area. And sitting to my right is my Chief of Staff, Michael Rivito. And he'll, if I can defer to him, he'll go ahead and explain slash T, the committee substitute, and then I'll roll into which I hope will be a quick, rapid-fire drill of my bill.
Okay, but first, after he tells us the exchanges and on changes, I'll have to remove my objection. But go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Michael Rivito, Chief of Staff for Senator Linda Menard. The changes in the committee substitute for version T for Senate Bill 80, the first change, it deletes in the entirety Section 1 of the original bill, which removes the obligation of the state language. Secondly, on page 2, line 30 of the CS, the word must has replaced the original word may. This makes clear that if Kabata receives revenue by way of any of the three means listed in that section, that revenue must go into the reserve fund that's being established by this bill. Lastly, the remaining sections of the bill were renumbered to reflect the deletion of Section 1 in the original bill.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there was, you said there's a deletion of the language that gave some people heartburn about the obligation of the state, but the state's still obligated? I'm not an attorney, but can someone explain that whether deleting the language about the obligation of the state really releases the state from obligation?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, what was deleted was an explicit mention of the obligation of the state. As I understand it, and there are people here who will testify to it, there still exists a moral obligation of the state. Kabata being a state corporation, so therefore, in essence, part of the state. But there are we have experts here that can testify more fully to that.
Okay, I appreciate that. But the layman's understanding would be that just getting rid of that language that caused some people heartburn doesn't really materially change the situation with the moral obligation, financial obligation of the state. I just want to make sure by the time we're through this process, we all understand who's on the hook or not on the hook for this significant amount of money.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
If you have any other questions on the CS? Go ahead and remove my adoption of the of CS version T. Do we have further objection to the adoption of CS version T? Seeing none, we have adopted version T as our working draft. Senator Menard, you want to explain this bill to us, please?
Yes. The CS you have in front of you will accomplish three items. It increases Kabata's authority to issue bonds from $500 million to $600 million. The bonds Kabata would issue are private equity bonds, which are federal bonds that are tax exempt and must be issued by a state agency, in this case, Kabata. It is very important to note that the state has no financial obligation with the bonds. We are just the conduit issuer. In that same theme, The CS also requires that the state bond committee reviewing the assurance of bonds by the state, ensuring they're conformed to a sound financial policy. Section 4 and 5 of the CS provide provisions for a project reserve fund that is established under Section 7 of the CS. The project reserve fund, titled the Connect Arm Crossing Fund, will be housed in the Department of Revenue, and as we spoke to later, we have someone here to answer those questions, and be used to satisfy the availability payment during the initial years of the bridge until the toll revenue becomes sufficient enough to retire the fund. Finally, Section 6 of the CS clarifies that the Connect Arm Crossing is exempt from state and local property taxes, whether operated directly by the public authority or on its behalf by a private partner. So in closing, the cost of not doing this bridge could be 3 to 4 times $1 billion, and this is as of 2008 figures estimated, to improve the Glen and Park Highway. I just want to make that statement. And those dollars would come out of the statewide transportation. So with that, I just wanted to share with you the new acronym for the bridge. It's called BOSS. It's Bridge of Statewide Significance. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So that's all you want to say on this bill?
I have the experts in the audience.
Right, but I have no we'll have a brief at ease. Here that are wishing to testify need to sign up to testify. If you haven't signed up,
Mr. Chairman, I could speak to availability payments if you wanted me to do that.
I think what we'll do is have a brief at ease here. Confusion. Normally what we have is a list of presenters to follow through, so it might be a little ad hoc today. So I guess with that brief introduction of the bill, we'll have we'll start with the public hearing portion. We have 1-0 physical note from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, which I would question as far as the 0 physical note impact to the state. With that, I'd like to go ahead and start with, I guess, Michael Forster.
Foster.
I need somebody to tell me what we're doing, or it'll be a short hearing.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Foster. I'm the chairman of the Connect Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. In the bill that Senator Menard just presented to you is language that we need in order to move this project forward. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the need of the project. Population. Population is the center for transportation needs. If we look at the population trend from 2010 to 2035, 25-year window, you'll see that the Mat-Su Borough in the Anchorage Metropolitan Transportation Plan, it's estimated that the Mat-Su Borough will increase by 119%, which is basically from 90,000 in 2010 to roughly 190,000 in 25 years, or actually 24 years. Also, the Metropolitan Transportation Plan, or MTP, also shows that from Eagle River to Kloutna, that area of Anchorage grows by 74%, from 39,000 to roughly 68,000, and then the Anchorage Bowl itself grows by about 15%. What those numbers show you is that the area of Anchorage, the land area of Anchorage, available land is readily being depleted. There isn't a lot of residential, business, or industrial land. It shows that the growth prediction is from Eagle River out to Kloutna, Peters Creek. And then a lot of the growth is happening in the Mat-Su Borough, which is currently already happening. Our models, state's models, and in fact the MTP is based on ICER's 2009 model The numbers I cited earlier, 119%, 74%, 15% comes out of that model, show that without a doubt, the south central area of Alaska is growing, and the Mat-Su borough is having significant growth, as well as the Eagle River Chugach area. After you look at the population, the next thing that comes to transportation is traffic. In 2010, at the Klutna bypass or Klutna bridge there, roughly 30,000 vehicles went under that bridge in 2010. 25 years ago, in 1985, roughly 15,000 vehicles went under that bridge on the Glen Highway, which is the first measuring point, really, of the northbound traffic coming into Anchorage. In 2010, at the weigh station or Highland, there's 52,000 vehicles coming into the Glen 6-lane. And in 1985, there was roughly 39,000. So you see a substantial growth between 1985 and 2010, which you also saw the same type of growth that we're predicting from 2010 to 2035. The traffic models that we've looked at and DOT has looked at, it shows that the Glen will go from 30,000 vehicles in 2010 at the Klutna overpass to roughly 60 to 65,000 vehicles, and that the Glen at the 6th lane will go from 52,000 vehicles to 110,000 vehicles. That is based on the population model without a bridge. So without a bridge, you see substantial traffic impacts or traffic growth. Today, and Jeff Otteson with DOT is here, and he can validate or comment on some of these numbers. Today, the Glen is basically at design capacity or level C. It doesn't mean you can't keep adding traffic to it. However, sooner or later, it becomes a parking lot. So can you add the growth to the Glen as it exists today? And the answer is yes. But you have a slowdown, a potential more accidents and other issues related to it, improvements to it, upgrades. So if you don't have a bridge, what's the cost of doing nothing? And the cost of doing nothing on the Glen is estimated in 2008 in a statewide transportation plan by DOT. The cost of upgrading the Glen for future population is $3 billion, and that was in 2008 numbers. And that was not the parks expansion, but just the Glen expansion. To handle that kind of traffic, the Glen would have to go from a 8-lane from Anchorage out to North Eagle River and a 6-lane from North Eagle River out to Wasilla, just based on the traffic projections. So doing nothing could cost the state in 2008 dollars, $3 to $4 billion. If you add on the parks, it could be greater than that. And so what we have here is the bill. In 2003, the legislature created Kubota with a mission to connect east side and west side of Cook Inlet through a crossing. Currently, we are in the public-private partnership procurement where a private partner would be responsible for financing, designing, building, operating, maintaining, and toll collection. The public part of this partnership is the toll revenue. The current structure is an availability payment, which means as toll revenue comes in, Kubota or the authority makes a payment on a quarterly basis to the developer for the cost of financing, designing, building, operating, and maintaining the bridge. So when you talk about the state's obligation or Kubota's obligation or the moral obligation, and I can comment on that a little bit more, it's the obligation to pay the developer for their investment. The current cost, capital cost estimate, is done by four different independent estimators. DOT did one, Major Projects Federal Highways did one, we've had two on our project. All put the bridge at about $720, $730 million for phase one. Phase one is the bridge itself, which is approximately a 9,200-foot span. It involves the connections on both sides, actually a 14,000-foot crossing, but the bridge itself is about 9,200 feet. It's the connecting roads, and it connects to the AC coupler. There's a cut-and-cover tunnel going through the Government Hill community. Phase two is, when traffic demands it, is the Ingram-Gamble connection, which would connect the bridge to Ingram-Gamble. Initially, the bridge is built as a four-lane foundation, so the bridge is actually built out for final completion. However, the initial deck is a two-lane. However, it's not what I call a residential two-lane. It's part of the National Highway System. It's actually a two-lane, 44-foot wide, so it has the 12 and 12 for your lanes and tens for your shoulders. So it's actually a substantially wide road. So you do have the ability to close part of it and still move traffic through it. Phase two will expand that to actually a four-lane with pedestrian and bike access on the bridge, too. So in essence, what this bill does is we currently have in legislation the ability to have $500 million in private activity bonds. And as Senator Menard talked about, these are a conduit through federal process that we as a state would provide a conduit for the private developer to go access these tax-exempt bonds. We also have revenue here today, and they can answer the committee's questions on the liabilities of this past or private activity bonds. However, I can tell you that they are not added to our book, the state's book, and they're not part of our bond capacity. They are strictly a pass-through private activity bond. We currently have, through the federal government, a capacity of $600 million. So this language here increases it to allow us to use that or allow the private contractor access that $600 million of tax-exempt bonds. Item number two on there has to do with property tax. We need to clarify to the private developer that they will not be liable for any property tax. The bridge, even during construction and after construction, is an asset of the state, belongs to the state, does not belong to the developer. The bridge is owned and controlled by Kubota or the state of Alaska. The private developer only has the availability payment or the obligation of the state. Item number three is the reserve fund, and the reserve fund is what we talk about. Senator Ellis talked about the moral obligation. We know the initial years of a 35-year concession with the private developer that the toll revenue will be short of our availability payment. The estimates we have over the course of those 7 years will be about $100 million short. The private developer wants to see that we have money in the bank or we have the mechanism to fund that shortfall until toll revenue catches up with the availability payment. The creation of that reserve fund is a mechanism that the private developer will look at and the funding in that reserve fund to show that they can get paid. After all, as I said earlier, the bridge belongs to the state, so we're asking a private developer to finance, design, and build and operate the facility, and in turn, they want to make sure that they're going to get paid their availability payment. Availability payment is kind of a term that's used in toll authority. It's kind of like a lease payment in a horizontal. The private partner just wants to make sure that they're going to get paid. So in essence, that's where the reserve fund is subject to appropriation, and that's where the moral obligation comes in, is there's a moral obligation that the state will fund this reserve fund, and then there's a moral obligation that the state will pay for this piece of infrastructure. Section 1 that was deleted was actually more of a black and white, the obligations of Kubota are the obligations of the state. Subject to $1 billion, and that was the original language. That's been changed to be more of the moral obligation related to the reserve fund subject to appropriation to handle the shortfall of toll revenue in the initial years. It's also estimated over the 35-year life of the concession, which is the contract that we're currently in the process of drafting. The state will receive approximately $1.1 billion in net revenue above and beyond the liabilities of Kubota to pay for their own operations and also make the availability payments to the private partner. This $1.1 billion in the first 35 years can be used statewide. It can be used for any Title 23 projects. It can be used for roads, ports, harbors, bridges, marine highways, anything eligible under Title 23, this reserve fund can pay for. Our estimate over the 60-year life, and we use 60-year because that's kind of a normal life cycle, is about $9.1 billion would be available for transportation needs statewide, whether that goes through the reserve fund or whether an independent transportation fund is created. That's to be seen in the future. However, currently excess toll revenue would come into the reserve fund, And then through the legislature and administration and DOT, it would be put back out through the STIP process for Title 23. The other point is, if you look at, let's go back to Do Nothing or No Bridge, I'll have to point out that the bridge is built for future needs, future transportation. Although the Glen, and I live north of Anchorage, although the Glen is congested at times, the Glen is still functional, except for on the first snow of every year, and then on fair days, the Glen's pretty impassable. But most of the time, the Glen is adequate for today's needs. The bridge is built for the future. It's built for future growth, future transportation, funding future transportation statewide. But you also have to look, and you know, if the bridge is not built and the state is left with having to upgrade the Glen and the Parks Highway, it could be a cost of $3 to $4 billion or more over the next 25 years, which Jeff Otis can discuss further, but that's a significant part of the statewide the STIP. And I know a lot of communities, a lot of areas of Alaska depend on that STIP for transportation funding. By going forward with the bridge, that will allow that funding to continue to be used throughout the state. At this point, you know, I can go on and tell you all the great merits and keep on talking, but I'm sure that I'm sure you want me to wrap it up so you can go to QAA or go to additional testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. There's, you know, there's some charts in here and some data, and I'm just kind of curious why you wouldn't walk the Finance Committee through some of your projections and your financial model. And I understand the off-balance sheet financing mechanisms, even though it may not show up as a direct obligation. We can fix it so there's no obligation if we really want to do that. So we're a little bit gun-shy on off-balance sheet financing here. So just you might want to address some of these things, your sensitivity to your traffic flows, your cash flow models. Where's the data to convince the committee that the exposure to the state is worth it?
Well, I appreciate the question. I have to beg your forgiveness. Actually, this is only my fourth committee I've been through. So I'm kind of picking up on the process here. We actually did the House Finance last week, and I was able to call our experts forward. So they're actually here. They're on the list for testimony. I was going to kind of defer to our experts on those. I didn't know at this point if you would like for me to bring those forward or do you have a different process. But today with us we have population and traffic model expert. We have our financial model expert. I'm sure that the questions that you have we can address, but right now it's sitting here. I would have to turn and refer to my consultants. Yes,
sir. It's difficult for me because I don't know the people and I don't know your project.
Okay.
But, you know, we're here to listen. So it's really up to you to put your product on the table, your project on the table, and show us what the impact is to the state and the finances. So if you have a couple of, you know, your support people, staff you want to bring forward, that would be fine. Somebody needs to tell us the exposure to the state.
If I could do this, and let me just ask you, I'll ask you the question, is my plan was, or my desire would be to let Mr. Otis and the DOT talk a little bit about the STIP and the Glen improvements, and then I could bring our city representative and then our Wilbur Smith representative.
What we're going to do is we're talking about the project. We'll bring DOT in after you do your presentation of your. So let's bring him up and let's talk about it. But we're not going to just gloss over the financial impact. So if you're not ready, prepared to address it, we'll have to do it at another day.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm prepared. Can I just ask the individual to come forward? Do I need to go through the chair?
Well, just mention who they are so I can.
It would be David Livingstone with Citigroup, and he would be addressing our financial model.
That's fine.
And I could bring him forward, and then Grant Holland with Wilbur Smith would be ejecting.
Stop. Okay. We'll have David Livingston from Citicorp come forward. You have a question?
Yes, I do.
And then Senator Ellis, Senator Egan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it concerns me. A half a dozen times you said moral obligation. I don't see this crossing as a moral obligation. I'm from Southeast Alaska. The co-chair is from Southeast Alaska. We thought the connection to Gravina Island was a moral obligation. So I just wish that moral obligation would stay out of this discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It is an issue. There's two bridges that we're talking about around the state. This is one of them. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Foster, thank you for your presentation. I feel like I have to bring up this. You made several references to Institute of Social and Economic Research in your presentation as a justification for the project and some of their projections, and you've received, and I can provide copies to the committee here, of a letter to you dated March 22nd of 2011. It's from Mr. Scott Goldsmith of ICER, and he objects in the strongest possible terms to your using their projections in the way that you've been using them in public presentations. He says on the second page, do not hide the numbers and imply that they are essentially the same as the ICER projection. I'm sure you remember this letter, but I guess in your public presentations you keep using ICER as a justification for the project and the projections that they've made to back up your projections. So I was surprised, frankly, for you to bring up ICER in your presentation to the legislature, because they've asked you to quit doing that. Can you comment on that, why you keep bringing up ICER when they disagree with your projections?
Through the chair.
Second, we're going to have a brief at ease. We've had passed out, looks like a memo to Michael Foster, Kinnickerm Bridge and Toll Authority, and I think this is the document that Senator Ellis is referring to. Is that correct, Senator Ellis?
Yes, sir.
And we've had that passed out to the committee because we haven't had a chance. That wasn't included in the pack. We've also had being copied right now a letter from Senator Thomas's office dealing with some questions and responses back, so they're being copied. We'll pass them out later. But to Senator Ellis, you want to go ahead and ask your question in reference to this letter, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my apologies to you and to the committee for not having this ahead of time. It's a memo. I refer to it as a letter. It's a memo from Mr. Scott Goldsmith of Institute of Social and Economic Research, the University of Alaska, from some time back to Mr. Foster. It was provided to me because people thought that Mr. Foster should be given the opportunity to respond to the question of why he keeps referring to ICER as a justification for the bridge when ICER disagrees with the other projections being made by Kapata. So that was, I'm representing that interest to just give Mr. Foster an opportunity to respond to why he would keep doing what he's doing.
Okay, Mr. Foster, I'm sure you're aware of this letter, correct?
That's correct.
Or memo. And could you respond to the concerns Senator Ellis has, please?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis. I did get the letter or memo on Friday, and we are working on a formal response to ICER. But in our defense, let me point out a couple things. In the package that was sent to you that has this table of population forecasts, the numbers that are under ICER 2009 are the numbers that are actually in the letter is what ICER believes would be accurate population numbers. ICER has asked us not to do a comparison to where I have said in the past, as their numbers are similar to ours or not that too far off. Today, in today's testimony, if you go back and look on the record, what I have referred to is the Metropolitan Transportation Plan for Anchorage. And on page 5-3 is regional population, household, and employment forecasts. As reported in this chapter, the primary source of population, household, and employment growth projections used for this MTP was the economic and demographic projections for Alaska and Greater Anchorage 2010 through 2035, prepared by ICER in 2009. Table 5.1 shows the population household, and it goes on, and it says the regional population growth projections show the most dramatic population growth occurring in the Mat-Su borough at 119%, followed by Chugiak, Eagle River, 74%, and the Anchorage Bowl, 15%. What I referred to in my earlier testimony was the 2035 Metropolitan Transportation Plan and the numbers that ICER has prepared or presented in this plan. If you go back and look, you'll note that I did not do a comparison between their numbers and our numbers.
Follow up on that?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought it was fair to give Mr. Foster an opportunity to respond, and I'll let the everyone can read the letter, and we'll let it speak for itself.
Okay, and then if I hear you correctly, Mr. Foster, you're going to have a written response to this. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then you can submit that to the committee, and I can dispense it to the committee members?
Absolutely, and we should have the response out by tomorrow, Wednesday.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Foster before we jump to Mr. Livingston? Mr. Livingston, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill and the project, please.
Sure. Thank you very much. I'm David Livingstone. I'm a managing director at Citigroup, a bank based in New York City. I'm financial advisor, and I have been financial advisor to the authority since 2007. I'm going to talk about two things. One is how the projections were developed, the analysis that we've done, and then what the results of those projections are. We take assumptions generated by others and put in a capital structure and financing assumptions and come up with what financial analysis. For the Kibata, we took capital costs, construction costs, assumptions that were developed by HDR and were verified, as the chairman said, by three other firms, all within a tight band.
And these financial stop there. HDR, if you want to define the acronym and who they are.
I believe they're called, they're HDR. HDR, they used to be called, well, it doesn't mean, HDR, they're a national civil engineering firm. They've got a large office in Anchorage. They design roads and bridges all across the United States, okay, including in Alaska. They were the primary one to develop these construction cost estimates. Several other firms came in and reviewed and basically audited them. HDR's construction cost estimates includes a $62 million contingency, construction contingency, where, you know, that take any potential cost overruns. We also took traffic and revenue projections by Wilbur Smith, and Grant Holland here is a representative of Wilbur Smith's. He can talk about the projections, traffic and revenue projections specifically, but I will say that Citigroup, we've been financing toll roads since the 1950s, and we have used Wilbur Smith's traffic and revenue projections in many, many financings, and lenders rely on Wilbur Smith's traffic and revenue projections in deciding whether to purchase a toll road debt. We've also taken another part of Wilbur Smith does operation and maintenance and capital expenditure projections and cost of running the toll systems, and we've taken their projections for the operating side of the project. From this, we dropped this into a financial model. We've taken we've developed a capital structure, which we believe one of these developers will use, which is financed with a combination of equity and debt. We've used, I believe, very conservative assumptions in terms of equity return. We've used a 12% equity return, where we've seen projects similar to this, availability fee, public-private partnerships, where the developers are taking less than 12% return. We've also used debt rates that are, you know, 50 to 75 basis points, you know, almost half to three-quarters of a percent higher than what we're seeing in the market today. So what we've taken all these assumptions and dropped it into a financial model that we've developed for Kibata, and fundamentally, The result is shown on, I think, the third last page of the projection, which I'd be happy to walk through.
And I'd like to also talk about your stress testing this, your models in your presentation, please.
Sure. In terms of the base case model, which you see here, the green shaded area are the projected toll revenues over the next 60 years. The red bars, the bars are the various expense categories, and the red bars, which you see over toward the left, are the availability fee payments that are made by Kabata to this private developer over the next 35 years from when commercial operation begins in 2016. A couple of notes to this. You can see in 2032, those availability payments step up. And that's because at that point, the developer is asked to add two additional lanes, one in each direction, on the bridge and the connecting roads on either side, because traffic warrants that. There's a tiny little sort of black or dark blue line bars above the red bars, which are Kabata's cost to manage the project. And the blue bars above, you know, there's the red bars, there's sort of these black bars, and then there's some blue bars. That is Kabata's cost to connect on the Anchorage side the toll road into Ingram Gamble Street. It's called the Ingram Gamble Connection. And that's the debt that Kabata issues for that. And then all the way sort of where the bars sort of drop down starting in 2053, this is after the concession is over, the private developer turns the road back over to the Kabata, and these are the costs to operate and maintain the road after that that happens. So you can see that in the first 7 or 8 years, the bars are higher than the revenue curve, and that's what the chairman was mentioning, that as the road ramps up, as development in Point McKenzie and north there develops, we expect that the availability payments are going to be greater than the toll revenues, and that's the 100 million or so, a little under 100 million, that Chairman Foster mentioned gets drawn out of the reserve fund during the initial years. And then you can see the space between the tops of the bars and the green shaded areas. That's the surplus revenues that are going to be available for transportation in Alaska over the 6-year term. And, you know, that totals $9 billion, although I would say the large majority of that's after 2052. In terms of sensitivities, I would say that first, we believe we've taken a conservative set of assumptions in developing these projections, but we have run sensitivities. We've run sensitivities. Wilbur Smith's traffic and revenue projections are based on their what they call their probable case, 50% likelihood of occurring. They also have run cases where what's the traffic and revenue at, 75% probability and 95% probability, meaning what's the traffic and revenue do they expect if you have a 95% probability that will occur? And I would say that that assumes a traffic haircut of about 25%.
Correct?
That's 25%. And under that case, where we leave all the other assumptions the same, but the traffic and revenue we assume is reduced by about 25%, the project still, over the first term of the concession, is cash flow positive to the state. But, you know, those projections could be shared as well.
Okay. So back up a little bit. You were talking about the equity return target somewhere around 12%. Is that correct?
That's what we've assumed in our model. That's
and then the cost of debt?
Cost of debt, it is 6.42% in the aggregate.
Right, and then the dollar amounts assigned to these?
We have assumed that the project is going to be funded with approximately $80 million of equity and approximately $710 million of debt.
Okay. And why doesn't the bank fully underwrite this? Because you're in the lending business. Why do you come to us? We're not a bank.
Well, you know, we have and we will lend money to projects. I'm working on a P3 elsewhere where Citibank is offered to lend money. But what we're talking about here is there are these availability that you have banks and equity investors willing to lend approximately a little under $800 million to build, finance, operate, and maintain this road. And in return, they're expecting Kubota to make payments, these annual availability payments, to allow them to recover their costs. Now, the private party is taking a lot of risk here. If they can't get this bridge built, they don't get paid anything, no availability payments at all. If they have $100 million of cost overruns, they have to reach in their own pocket and pay for them and get the bridge up and running, because that's the only way they will start getting paid their availability payments. If it turns out that the cost to operate and maintain this road is higher than their projections, they have to reach in their pocket and pay for that, because Kubota's not obligated to do that. But what they're saying is, if I do my end of the bargain, I build the bridge, I make it available for service, and I operate and maintain it the way I'm supposed to, I expect some assurance that I'm going to get paid to do that, and that's these availability payments. And what we're asking the state to do, or Kubota's asking the state to do, is to say, hey, under our base case projection, we don't think we're going to have to come back to the state for any future appropriations other than this initial deposit to the reserve fund. But under a case, if we have another recession, you know, 3 years from now, and traffic ends up being a lower for a period of time, they want to make sure that, you know, Kubota has an ability for them to uphold their side of the bargain, which is to, you know, make these availability payments. And that's what we're asking the state.
So then this is, you know, I'd classify this as a mega project, pretty close to a $1 billion project. Most of these mega projects go with cost overruns, and when I've been told, if they're 20% over, that's a success. If you're 100% over, then that's a problem.
Right.
So just assume that this does go to cost overruns. You know, you're looking at probably a couple hundred million, maybe. Where does that couple hundred million come from, and how does the state protect itself so we don't have that put to us?
That comes from the concession company. If they can't get the thing built for what they say, that's their risk. I'll give you an example. This is, you know, what I would call a P3 disaster. SR 125 in San Diego, it's a toll road that runs in San Diego. It's a new border crossing, but it primarily serves a new development in southeastern San Diego. Mm-hmm. The road went into operation in, I think, 2008, just as the financial crisis and the subprime issues hit. And, you know, this was largely a development, a road for development. And so the project first had about $200 million of cost overruns. It was a concession between Macquarie, which is a big Australian concession company and bank, and the state of California, Caltrans, which is the California Department of Transportation. I think it's something like $200 million cost overruns. State didn't have to put out a penny. That was Macquarie and the contractor's risk, and they funded it and got the road up and running. The road didn't meet projections and ultimately went and filed for bankruptcy. Again, the road didn't cost the state anything. They, the lenders, and took a haircut, you know, and ultimately SANDAG, which is a state, a San Diego Regional Government Authority, decided to buy the road at cents on the dollar. But they didn't have to. And I think what I'm trying to demonstrate is, you know, this delivery approach, which is the reason why Kubota selected it, is to try to make sure things like the Big Dig don't happen here, where there are tremendous cost overruns, which are going to be on the backs of Alaskans. These guys expect the private equity is expecting to make a 12% return, and he's making that return because he's taken that cost overrun risk, and he's taking the operation rate and maintenance risk, not the state or Kubota.
So there's no way the risk exposure to the state goes over $700 million in debt issuance, is that what you're telling me? And there's no way that this thing could be put back to the state, and we can do our stress tests, and it's going to match up with what you're telling me?
I think that by and large is true. And the reason why I say by and large is true, there are a half a dozen events where Kubota would have to put more money in. And those are sort of uncontrollable circumstance events. Kubota has done soil testing all along where this bridge is going to go. If it turns out that where the piers go, the soil's different than where what the test was, you know, whatever, 20 yards from there, Kubota may end up having to make additional payments for that. But these small subset of risks, in our view, and actually I really should turn it over to the engineers, are relatively small amounts of money in the scheme of what could go wrong in the construction of a road like this.
Okay. So that small amount of risk, I guess, I'm just still kind of curious what potentially could roll back to the state if we pass this piece of legislation.
What can roll back to the state is the availability payments. If the toll revenues are lower than what's projected, the availability payments are, are these numbers, the state may be asked for future appropriations. And as I said, even if the toll revenues were haircut 40%, so if toll revenues were 40% lower than what we're showing here, and has Wilbur Smith in the last, the 22 deals done, in the, have any been 40% low?
One
of the 22 projects that they have done traffic and revenue projections for since 1999 has been more than 40% below projections. Mm-hmm. But even at 40% below, the project is cash flow neutral to the state over the term of the concession.
When Citicorp looks at a project, do they stress test it and look at the impact to Citicorp?
Oh, absolutely.
Where's your stress test in this project so we can see what the impact of the state is?
Well, I think the stress test, one is to start by using conservative assumptions. And, as I said, there's a significant construction contingency in there. There's significant contingency in the operation maintenance expenses, contingency in the fact that we've used higher rates than in today's markets and higher equity return than we believe the concession the developer will assume. But, as I said, we have, run hundreds of different projections for Kubota, including some that assume lower toll revenues than we've assumed here.
Right.
And as I said, what those have shown is even at a 40% toll haircut, the project ends up being cash flow neutral to the state over the 35 years.
Okay, but I don't see those in my packet, so maybe you could.
They're not, I agree.
Right, so.
We can provide those to you if you would like.
Yes, we're definitely interested in our exposure. Not much different than I think your your employer is interested in the exposure he may have. And it's still not clear to me if there's a $200 million cost overrun, unless the equity investor is going to write another check for $200 million and hold the debt constant and eat it into his 12% return, which maybe is the case. Well, but I'm just curious as far as that goes. And then even though those the exposure you'd mentioned being minor in those, you were using, soil samples or what have you, you know, where that is, because as far as the risk to the state.
I certainly can't address the risk of the soil testing. That's for the engineers. But I would say in terms of what happens if there's a $200 million cost overrun, typically happens in a situation like this is lenders, you know, equity has an ability, if they can see that it's another 25 or 50 million that they would put in and they can solve the problem and get the thing up and running, they will probably do that. To the extent it's greater than that, they'll probably walk away and leave the lenders, holding the bag. And the lenders have a choice. Do I want to put more money in and ultimately, you know, have Kabat and the state start paying the availability payments, so hopefully I get, whatever, 70 or 80 cents on the dollar as opposed to nothing, which is the risk, because Kabat doesn't have an obligation to make payments to them unless the bridge is up and running. So, Kabat could make a decision like in San Diego and say, I'm willing to buy this thing, it's this bridge at cents on the dollar, finish it up. But that's a decision Kabat has to make, will make at that time. They don't have to do that.
Because just, you know, if you got $80 million in equity and $700 in debt, you know, round it off, you know, you're looking
10%. 10% equity, that's right.
So you've got a very heavy leverage position.
We do.
And the Citicorp's role in this is what?
Financial advisor.
Right. To who?
To Kabat. In fact, because we're financial advisor, we can't be a lender to the project because we have a fiduciary responsibility to Kabat, and there's a view that if we're a lender as well as a financial advisor, we're sort of a conflicted position. That's one of these things under MSRB and Dodd-Frank that we can't take both of those roles.
Okay.
If the chair could allow me to expand a little bit on the procurement process.
Go ahead, and then we're going to go to a question from Senator Thomas.
The procurement process, we actually went through a statement of qualifications in 2011. We put it out for an open process through the market. We received six what I call concessions, and the concessions are made up of equity partners, financial partners, contractors, designers, builders, toll collectors, operators. They're fairly large concession groups. From that list of six and a statement of qualifications, through a very formal process, it was shortlisted down to three that were invited to submit a proposal. Currently, we're working on that draft RFP, and the draft RFP is being worked through our authority, through the Department of Law, and then also the administration has a representation also at that RFP or contract process. And at the end of when the formal RFP is completed and we're waiting to complete that RFP, waiting to see what legislation we can identify in there, the proposers of these three concessions of them will prepare bids. The bids are primarily the availability payment. They've already been shortlisted on qualifications and financial stability. Now they're going to get right down to what is it going to cost or what payment are they looking for based on design criteria and limitations that we place. If we get to a point near the end and it doesn't pencil out for the state certainly has the ability not to go the next step further, which is the issuance of a contract. We believe that it will, based on the models that we've looked at, talking to the concessions. At the point that the state, or Kabata, I keep saying state, but Kabata enters into a contract with the successful proposer, we're committing to making that availability payment. They're committing to financing, designing, building, operating, maintaining, collecting tolls. If there's a cost overrun, price of steel goes up, workforce issues, that's their problem. If there's a 20% overrun on construction, that's their problem, not ours. Our contract is that annual payment that we make as an availability payment. And, in fact, we don't make a payment until the bridge is open. And so the longer it takes in the builder, whatever delays they have, it's a cost to them. There are penalties if they don't clear the snow within a certain amount of time, if they don't have traffic lanes open, if they don't collect the tolls. There are penalties that are applied through this contract, which is a pretty standard public-private partnership type contract. So the risk to the authority is the payment of those availability payments, which is what we look for in that reserve fund to handle the shortfall. Kabata, the state, is not liable for poor performance as far as cost overruns or additional O&M costs. I guess the answer to your question is we're on the hook for the availability payment. That's what we're on the hook for.
Well, I don't know. And we're just getting into this, but, I mean, I'm looking at a $1 billion project at 10% down, potentially a 20% overrun, which what I've been told is pretty normal in mega projects. So the concern I have is it's a lot of leverage, and I know the state's got the deepest pocket of anybody in the game, and I know how that works. It gets put to us. So I'm a little bit concerned that we don't have an open-ended process here, you know, as we go through this, and I am concerned that we don't have much of a financial presentation in front of us on a $1 billion project. So, you know, it is what it is today, and we're going to walk through it. But these are significant sums of money with potential a fairly sizable exposure to the state if this thing turns upside down.
Understand. Just a comment, you know, any time there's an infrastructure development, you know, it's going to cost somebody money. And the state could do this in their traditional, you know, design, bid, build, operate themselves. You know, they know they're going to be on the hook for, you know, $700+ million to build the project and more to operate and maintain it. You know, here under our projection, you know, the state is on the hook. Again, if this bill passes and the legislature decides to appropriate the $150 million that we're asking for the reserve, that'll be the only under the base case. And I agree there are sensitivities, and but under the base case, using what I believe are conservative assumptions, you know, the state will never have to put any more money into the project, and in fact, we'll get the $150 million back at the end of the concession. So. You know, okay. I guess it's something to weigh. You know, there's the option of not doing anything, but, you know, to the extent the bridge, you know, is something that the state is interested in moving forward on, you know, there's going to be a cost to it one way or another.
And I see maybe we'll move on and have, because I'm watching the clock. Is it Grant Holland? Is that right? If he can come forward. Sometimes it's hard to read the, you know, the handwriting, but. But if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then help us, I think, with the traffic analysis, was your part of the project?
I'd be glad to, Senator. Okay. My name is Grant Holland. I'm a vice president with the firm of CDM Smith. For point of clarification, last year, CDM, which is a large international engineering firm, merged with Wilbur Smith Associates, which was my former employer, and the new name is now CDM Smith. We still have the same obligations and the responsibilities that we had previously. CDM Smith and its predecessor firm, Wilbur Smith Associates, have been doing traffic and revenue studies since at least the early 1950s. We are considered in the industry as the premier traffic and revenue consultant. We have, since that time, over $83 billion worth of bonds. Toll revenue bonds have been financed based upon our traffic and revenue studies. We have developed proprietary traffic and revenue forecasting models, travel demand models. The reason for this is that we discovered early on that most travel demand models used by MPOs and regional planning agencies did not reflect tolls very well. They were not created to deal with tolls. We have also not only recognized by the investment community as the premier traffic and revenue consultant, we have also been retained and have worked on a very regular basis training Federal Highways, training rating agencies, training TIFIA, we did some work for TIFIA, and training toll authorities on how to conduct the intricacies of traffic and revenue projections, et cetera. So again, we are, this is something we do as a bread and butter piece of our business. When we start looking at a project, and I think this is important to understand, we look at it from the standpoint of what we consider to be, I think the bankers use the term essentiality. We look at it as what's the internal logic to this project. We ask ourselves the beginning question, why would someone use this facility? In this case, when we look at the Kinnick Arm Crossing, it is a bridge that connects a landmass or an area, being Anchorage, which is completely bound from development standpoint. Mountains, military bases, and water. It is connecting to the only near place to a major port, to an area with lots of private land for development purposes. The alternative to this bridge from these areas is a 90-mile, an 80 to 90-mile drive, depending on how you look at it. That is a fairly significant issue that you say there's a logic to why people would use this bridge. We then start our studies. We've done actually three studies on this particular project, at least three. In 05, we did what we refer to as a sketch-level traffic and revenue study. That's a very inexpensive, very quick study where we basically rely upon publicly available information. That study was also done with a different intent in mind. That study was done, the question was asked us, if you remember at that stage, Representative Young had an earmark for this project. Question was, how much money can we raise to cover the shortfall between the earmark and what was projected to need at the time? In 07, we completed what we refer to as an intermediate traffic and revenue study, which is the next step below an investment grade where we would go to the market. It contains every piece of analysis, if you will, that we would do for an investment grade study. We didn't take it to an investment grade study because at the time Kubota was not actually doing the investing or was not going to finance it themselves. And typically our obligation then goes to Kubota. It doesn't go to the financing. The concessionaires would do the financing based on their studies at that stage. In 2011, we updated that study to reflect current market conditions and changes in the market at that time. Moving on, we started the study we look at several factors when we start studies. We look at the local forecasts in the area. We looked at the ICER studies. That was the basis for our beginning study in 07. We looked at the Bureau of Labor. We looked at an independent study done by a firm called Woods and Poole, which is a nationally recognized economic forecasting firm. As is often the case with investment grade studies or studies you take to the market, there's often a requirement for what they refer to as an independent economic analysis, and there's a reason that they do that. What we have found, or what the markets have found, both the private equity markets and the rating agencies and the lenders, is that local forecasting agencies have their own biases to them for various reasons. Not suggesting in here, and please do not interpret what I said, that I'm making any comment about ICER or anyone else who's done forecasts locally. This is something that has just historically, is a historical fact from lower down, from the lower 48. So as a requirement of that, they would like us, or they require us now, to bring in an independent firm to kind of verify or go through those forecasts to get a, what they refer to as an independent analysis. We did that. We brought a firm called Insight Research Corporation. I believe I got the full name correctly. But Insight came in, did the analysis. At this point, I'd like to kind of discuss a little bit about how economic modeling occurs. There are two, and probably more, but in this, in most cases, there are two approaches to it. One approach is to start at kind of where we know historically and work our way down. The other approach is to start at a much more granular level and work your way up. Please don't interpret that these are by any means mutually exclusive analyses. These are, there's actually quite a bit of overlap between the analyses. What we did is we started from a granular level. We started at what we call a TAS, or traffic analysis zone level. We went out, we talked to 23 people who are responsible for the planning, for the management, for the economic growth people in the Anchorage area, both Anchorage, the MATSU, people with Alaska and University of Alaska and Fairbanks, people with, I think we spoke to the commanding officers of J-Bear, of Elmendorf and Richardson Air Force Base. We also went and talked to their planning departments, and we looked at what were their planning, what were their plans, what were the projects that were on their books, where were they located, and what was driving those projects. Now, realize we didn't look, the bridge has an impact area. We call it like the watershed. Obviously, if you are in Wasilla, this bridge has very little use to you. But if you are looking at developing industrial area in the Port McKenzie area, this bridge is very important to you. So we really focused on those areas that were going to be impacted by the bridge for the bulk of our analysis. From that, we then built going back up, compared it to historical trends that are reported by various agencies, ICER, Department of Labor, et cetera, the Census Bureau. I think it's interesting to note that in the 07 study, there was a difference between our forecasts and the ICER forecasts on population. There was, though, in terms of employment in the MATSU, we were virtually identical on employment in the MATSU. In the update that we did in 2011, going back and comparing to the 09 projections, which ICER did, again, on population, we were relatively close, not identical. We were a little bit higher. I should actually back up. The difference was about 8,000 between us in 2035. ICER projected in 2010 that the MATSU would have about 80,000 people in it. We projected about 88,000. In 2010, the census came out, and the census showed that there were 89,000 people in the population of the MATSU. One of the interesting things that we found in our study, in comparing our studies to the to ICER studies and other studies in the area, is ICER and Wilbur Smith had almost the identical compound growth rate, which was 3.1%, is what we were projecting to 2030. If you adjust numbers to the actual census numbers that are out there, again, our projections would become very, very close to each other. With that, I would answer any questions that you have.
Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate your presentation. And the question that I have revolves around the projections for the population growth, or whatever it is you're anticipating. I was surprised to say that you just said that if you live in Wasilla, you wouldn't be particularly concerned about this. This would be more the anticipation of the buildup and development of the area in Point McKenzie. Is that?
It's true as it relates to what I said about Wasilla. What we estimated is kind of the break point, the waterfall, if you will, is in the near term is the Kinnick area and the Fairview area, and then going out, it goes up to the Big Lake, Big Bear. It's that line right there, which is really kind of the waterfall both directions.
If I may, so that's the numbers that you're looking at, and that would be vehicle crossings of 37,000 or more, and still a doubling even of the Eklutna Bridge. If I read the numbers correctly, maybe I'm not interpreting them correctly, but it says that at 2009, the daily crossings of the Kinnick River and the Glen Highway was 26,000 and anticipated to be 54,000 or 52, depending on whose report, in 2035. And with that, yet there would still be 37,000 crossings of the Kinnick Arm Bridge.
I think, as the chairman pointed out, without the bridge, there is significant. The growth is coming into the MATSU. I think we have seen nothing that suggests to us that the growth is not occurring in the MATSU. That growth is going to generate traffic, and both in terms of generating traffic going somewhere and coming back as well. So. That growth, again, when you build the bridge kind of shifts where the growth goes. And so, yes, in the alternative, that traffic will be, that at least most of that traffic will be going onto the Glen Highway.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, could I add to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
In 1985, at Eklutna Bridge, it was counted roughly 15,000 cars. Went underneath that bridge on an annual average daily traffic count. 2010, that number was 30,000. If you look at the population of the borough roughly approximately doubled in that time frame. The population that we look at, if it is 119% as indicated in the Anchorage Metropolitan Traffic Plan, that traffic will increase to between 60 and 65,000 by the year 2035 at that Eklutna point. And so if you look at the historic traffic, the current traffic, and the projected traffic coming into the Glen without a bridge, it was 15,000 25 years ago, 30,000 a day, and it'll be 65,000 in 25 years. So if you build a bridge, some of that population growth, as I said earlier, the bridge is not for today's population. It really is, well, there'll be some people using it, but it really is for the future population growth. It's for that 119% or predicted or a portion thereof. So we know without the bridge, the Glen is going to double. We know if there is a bridge, some of that traffic will divert to the bridge.
That gets right to the point of my question, because when I add those two numbers together, I get about a 3.5 times increase, and it doesn't seem like it's actually having any impact on the traffic that's traveling over the Glen Highway, the Kinnick River Bridge on the Glen. That is adding simply the 37,000 trips across the Kinnick Arm crossing, if I'm interpreting it correctly from the Department of Transportation's letter anyhow. So my concern there is how you calculate that amount of activity, and if in fact that's not accurate, the impact that it has on this, particularly looking at the typical lifespan of the bridge of 30 years and going forward to that point in time, and looking at, there is no surplus obviously at that point in time. If you follow that orange line, if I've got the lines right there correctly, there's a couple of colors that are very similar. So that concerns me. If you're that far off, you're not making your annual payments, and you're not picking up a variety of other costs that are interest costs, et cetera. So causes me even more concern looking at something like that happening going forward, and trying to tell people that $9.5 billion in surplus revenue is going to be spread around. Because if I was one of those people traveling across that bridge and paying a certain amount of money, I would be pleased to see that when the bridge was paid off, that the toll was reduced rather than left the same to build projects around the countryside, as might be referred to. So I just am curious about the numbers and how confident people feel about them, to the fact that even the contractor has no recourse if, in fact, those numbers are wrong.
Mr. Holland, could you help him with that, please?
Yeah, I will. I will do my best. One of the things that we have found in our studies is that the bridge itself actually induces growth, particularly around the Port McKenzie area, because it reduces the travel time into Anchorage significantly. I think it's 89 miles or 90 miles. Our report actually points out what the different savings is. That's a significant savings in time, and as a result, we actually project significant growth through the 2035 in that area. So you can't just take the bridge actually increases overall travel demand, if you will. It's not an additive issue. It actually increases the number of trips overall that does it. Regarding the issues about what happens after the concession goes away or the concession expires in 35 years, I believe that's really a state issue as to whether or not they want to maintain the tolls or not at that stage. That is beyond the purview of a traffic and revenue consultant. Did that help at all?
Well, I guess it, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess it explains somewhat of your thinking there, and I guess the 89 miles, I'm not sure what that is in reference to, and the concept of relying on the build the bridge and it's going to fill up the area across the bridge kind of concept that bothers me a little bit.
Let me, the 89 miles, we measured from basically, I believe, at the edge of there's a planned intersection on the west side of the crossing, and we kind of measured from that spot. We actually drove it all the way around to someplace in central Anchorage, just as a way to get a measure, if you will, a proxy of what that distance might look like. And I believe it was about 89 miles. Okay. So that's where the 89 miles comes from, Sandra. Now, why we believe that there would be growth in that particular area comes from a couple of pieces of evidence that we have. One, it is a deep water port. Those are valuable when it comes to shipping goods and services, especially when you're shipping natural resources or those sort of things, which we understand is really what that port is intended to do. Talking to people at Port McKenzie, or it is our understanding that the isolation, if you will, from the rest of the state, from Anchorage itself and from the road networks, has retarded the growth of Port McKenzie. Again, that is our understanding from talking to people. Third piece of evidence that we have is looking at the projects that are planned in the area, both in terms of industrial, commercial, and retail in the Port McKenzie area. What's currently on the books that they're looking at suggests to us that those levels of traffic and development is coming once the bridge gets done, because again, the bridge eliminates this 89 mile trip to about a 15 mile trip.
Through the chair.
Just a second. Go ahead. Next question.
Just one short thing then, in that case. So just to make sure I understand, you're saying that if the bridge were not built and somebody was working at one of these facilities you're talking about that would be built on the north side of the inlet there, across the bridge, Port McKenzie, let's just say. Right. Let's make it real simple. If somebody's working in Port McKenzie, the 89 miles you're talking about is for them to drive all the way around and come back into central Anchorage or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
All right. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back a bit to the Whittier Tunnel. I've been told that it was some iteration of Wilbur Smith that worked with DOT to make the traffic projections for the Whittier toll, the Whittier Tunnel, and the toll charge there for that facility. Independent folks who've looked at that experience, even though it's a tiny project compared to this mega project proposed by Kubota, but folks have basically said that DOT and Wilbur Smith worked together to, and in the end, grossly overestimated the traffic there, the demand for use of that toll facility. some people say wildly inflated, other people say grossly overestimated. Some people in state government felt burned at the time by this firm that, you know, is proud of its reputation, but in that instance, somebody failed spectacularly in making accurate estimates for us to base public policy and budget decisions on. So I guess my question is, why wouldn't we have some trepidation with the work of this firm and DOT working together to make traffic projections when they've been so wrong in the past on a much smaller project?
Senator, with respect, I know nothing about the Whittier Tunnel. It was done way before my time, so I cannot address what was done or wasn't done at the Whittier Tunnel. Again, my apologies for that. As to why you should believe Wilbur Smith on this project, since 1995, there have been 22 greenfield, and greenfield is a term of art that we use for projects like the Kinnick Arm that are brand new projects that are just new projects. Yep. 22 of those projects have been financed since 1995 with Wilbur Smith Traffic and Revenue Studies. Of those, 10 have actually exceeded our projections in the first 5 years. And I say the first 5 years because those are actually the most critical time period for a greenfield project in terms of revenue projections. 10 of them exceeded our projections. Another 4 were within 90%. In fact, 3 of them were within 95%, and one of them was within 97% of our projections. I can only stand on the reputation. Again, Senator, I do not know what happened at Whittier. I cannot speak to Whittier.
Okay. Follow-up questions? Okay. Thank you, guys. Next up, Jeff Otteson.
Mr. Chairman.
You have a question?
Absolutely.
Okay. Just hold a second, Mr. Otteson. And your question is to who?
I'm not sure who to ask it to, but looking at the survey that was handed out in our packet dealing with the opinions of the 2012 legislative session dated March 2012, on page 5, you note that 58% of the people that were surveyed did not want the Kubota Bridge to be built. And if you look at that, on page 10, it looks like 61% of the people were from either South Central or from the Anchorage itself. And I was wondering if you might comment on that, being a public policy and up for re-election this year. Why would, if there's such a significant number of people that are from South Central Alaska that do not want it built, why are we going ahead?
Mr. Foster, can you help him with that question?
Through Chair, Senator Olson. I don't have the numbers right in front of me. I have seen the Dittman survey that was done for the caucus. And there are, if I recall right, and you have it there are three numbers, and the one is build it now, build it later, or not build it. Mm-hmm. To us, it's a sum total of build it now or build it later is what we look at as being a positive. As we usually do before session, Dittman does a comprehensive survey for this project, and it's in your package. And it shows, I have the full package here, the full survey, but we only have the two pie charts in your submittal. And it says one of the questions is, will the Glennon Park site be adequate for future growth? And, you know, it says 6%, 60% says it's not, or 11% says we're unsure. You know, with everything said, should we wait until later or should we build it now? And 65% of Alaskans say build it now. Over 70% of South Central says build it now. And so I look at the survey that was done in December that had a lot of questions to it in combination to the survey that the legislature did, where I take those first two, build it now, build it later. To me, build it later could be 2015. And they're saying, you know, they're in favor of the bridge. It kind of matches up to the pie chart that we currently have.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I can assure you we don't run the Finance Committee appropriations by polls. So we'll, you know, take those with a grain of salt, but it won't be a battle of the polls. And thank you guys for coming in today. Next up, Jeff Otteson. And Mr. Otteson, if you have any other guy with DOT with you, you can bring him forward. You're a one-man band. Mr. Otteson, you've been here numerous times. If you could, you know the drill, so what do we got in front of us after you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jeff Otteson, Director of Program Development with Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I'm not sure I really have a formal presentation for you today. I was here mostly for questions, but I can say a couple things about the administration's view on the project and on the legislation. On the project, the administration is still actively waiting for the project to proceed to a point to where it's truly ready, that it has all its permits and is ready to go. We're monitoring the legislation, and we'll make a decision on this legislation at such time that it's completed in its final form and is available for the governor to review. From a statewide perspective, the project is viewed as being important to the state, not just to Matsu Borough, not just to Anchorage, but to the state. If you just step back and look at the map, you've got the Anchorage Bowl and its population and the Kenai Peninsula Borough and its population connected by a thin line called the Glen Highway to the rest of the state to the north. You, in essence, have a single transportation corridor for a very large fraction of the state's population with no alternative in places. And if you've ever been on that highway when there's been a major tragedy and a crash of some type, it stalls for hours. There's no redundancy. Even our smaller communities come looking to DOT to build them alternative routes so they have redundancy. Juneau has asked for it. Kodiak has asked for it. Ketchikan has asked for it. And yet here you have a situation where you have much larger bodies of population that are tied by a single route. There's been a lot of talk earlier today and last year about what projects would be precipitated and needed as a result of the bridge. In other words, is the state signing on for the bridge? Are you then signing on for a lot of follow-on work that then is necessitated by the bridge? That's a very difficult question to answer. But if I tried to look at it from big picture, as you look at the population growth that's coming, that Chairman Foster has talked about, that population growth already has and is continuing to create a demand for roads to be built both in Anchorage and on the Glen Highway, the Parks Highway, and then later in the Matsu Borough to address that growth. All that is happening right now. And many, many roads are being upgraded or being requested to be upgraded as a result of that growth. What this bridge does is start to build some of that needed capacity off the books of the state general fund and off the books of the state's federal funding source. In other words, it's bringing new money to the table. And that new money is essentially helping to build capacity we would otherwise have to build ourselves. I think that's the simplest way of looking at this, as opposed to saying, well, if we build it, then we have to build a bunch of new roads. We're going to have to build those roads anyway. Almost all the roads that might be considered because the bridge were built are being considered right now without the bridge, a certainty. So I don't know that you can draw a very clear black and white conclusion about the bridge will then lead to more bridges or more road work that is otherwise not necessary. I think with that, I'll just stop and see if there's questions, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Otteson today? Well, we'll start with Senator Ellis and then Senator Thomas. And does Senator Olson, you have a question?
Yes.
And he'll follow Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand there's a LBNA audit going on. Would DOT have any problem waiting until the audit is completed and moving forward with your work on the project?
I'm aware of that audit through the chair, Senator Ellis. There's an audit underway regarding the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority, and of course there is a financial relationship. They are housed within the DOT, much as the railroad is housed in the Department of Commerce. So I've not even met with the auditors, so I have no knowledge at all.
So do you have a problem waiting on the results of the audit before you perform any more work in the department?
I'm sorry, Mr. Senator Ellis, I am hard of hearing, and so I didn't quite catch that first question.
Could you please repeat the question?
I've got it now. I know of no reason. Are you suggesting we wait till the audit is over to decide whether this legislation should proceed? Is that the answer?
Go ahead and repeat your question, please.
Sure. It could be further work by the department on the project to facilitate the project, or whether you all support the legislation. Do you think the audit's important, and do you plan to factor it into your thinking on the project and on your support for the legislation?
I'm not sure I have an answer to that right now. I would rather get back to you with an answer to that.
If you can get back to the committee on the answer to the question of the audit.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do have a follow-up. Mr. Otteson, were you around during the Whittier Tunnel? The outrageous projections that were made with that, the gross overestimation or purposeful inflation, were you part of that, or do you know who was? How did we get into that mess with the Whittier Tunnel not panning out the way you all predicted?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, the story that I heard around the coffee pot, and I was a much more junior grade planner at the time,
sure,
is that that project was championed by the governor at the time. He asked a senior engineer in DOT to lead that project forward, really over the objections of the rest of the department, and it was that effort that what led to the project.
So another, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I promise this will be the last for this presenter. But so, Mr. Otteson, and I understand you were a junior grade person at the time, but is it safe to say that experience would teach us that if powerful political forces, a governor or other powerful political interests, want DOT to stand by projections that most folks would think were out of line and outrageously inflated, that kind of political pressure can be brought to bear and DOT will do what is necessary to get a project built in terms of projections? If that's the case, it's very troubling. I'm not going to ask you to take responsibility for something that didn't happen on your watch, but it's just, I think, instructive for our work here today.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Thanks, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure you have before us. I know the committee now has a letter from the State of Alaska DOT, Commissioner Lucan, regarding some questions I asked last year at the DOT, or at the DOT committee, Department of Transportation, or Transportation Committee. And rather than run through all of the numbers and try and figure those out, because they're a large number when you add them up, you have done or somebody in the office has done a fair job of summarizing those numbers on page 3, the third paragraph, and maybe you could address that. I realize some of it's federal money, some of it's state money, but it's a staggering number, and just kind of explain how that fits in. And those are all projects that are intended to be or expected over some period of time to be associated with the Kubota.
And could you please repeat where you are in this letter so we can...
We're on page 3 of the letter dated March 8, 2011, from Commissioner Mark Lugan, Department of Transportation. Page 3, the third paragraph on that page.
Just to clarify, Senator Thomas, this is the letter from Commissioner Lucan to yourself, April 7th, page 3?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
If I may read from the record, Mr. Chair, the total cost of projects not covered by toll revenue that influence bridge and general network traffic flow is $1.8 billion. Approximately $1.4 billion of that is in Anchorage and another $400 million in Matsu to be constructed over a 20-year period. Regular federal highway aid funding requires a 10% match. This leaves $1,620,000,000 that must be funded from regular highway aid dollars. Dividing that amount over a period of 20 years results in a hypothetical annual federal highway funding need for those projects of $81 million per year. The state currently receives $400 million in regular federal highway funding per year. allocating $81 million per year for the regional network project would amount to a little more than 20% a year of the overall amount.
Okay.
Well, are you asking me to comment on the on how that sort of fits into the scheme of things?
Fits into the scheme, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It fits into the scheme of things as well as how practical that seems to be with the status of the federal government now and the what I expect is going to be a decrease in federal funding and how that then impacts, which may isn't your purview, I guess, but goes back to the Kabata folks, so how that potentially affects the reality of the tolls that would be expected to be collected on the bridge if, in fact, we did not receive these types of money and expend these types of money on that on those projects that are expected to influence that project. Kind of complex, but that's the concern, I guess.
Can you help, Mr. Robinson, can you help the committee with the broader view?
That's a wide-ranging question, but I'll do my best, Mr. Chair and Senator Thomas. This first talk about federal funding. Federal funding is at a precarious point. We don't know our future. The Senate has passed a bill that would actually increase funding for the state. The House has proposed a bill but not passed it that would decrease funding for the state. They have opted, I believe, just as we've been sitting here this afternoon, to extend the old bill down another 3 months. They can't find a way in the House of Representatives to pass the highway bill. We'll see whether or not we get an extension. That said, we don't know our future, and we won't know our future probably could be for months, it could be for years, in terms of what the future federal highway program is. We are facing somewhere in the range of a cut and an increase. We just don't know which. I think it's really more instructive, though, when you look at numbers like we're describing this paragraph, to understand these needs are driven by the population growth the state is facing. That's what's driving it. It's not any particular project like the Kinnickahn Bridge. It's the fact that growth is occurring. You heard the estimate, 120% growth in Mat-Su Borough, 74% growth in the Eagle River, Chugach area. Those growths generating more drivers, more traffic, and that traffic needs to be accommodated right now on the singular Glen Parks Highway. There's approximately 12 interchanges on that route as you get to Wasilla. There's three major bridges, and as you widen the highway from 4 to 6 lanes, from 6 to 8 lanes, you have to reconstruct and reconfigure all those other investments. The interchanges have to change. The bridges have to change. And all that has to happen in an area where you have urban land use, so you're buying up property, you're buying up expensive property, you're relocating utilities, you're fundamentally, and you're accommodating traffic all the time that you make these improvements. I can tell you that our urban projects today often cost more for the non-construction part of the project than they do for the construction part. And by that I mean the right-of-way, the utility relocation, and the traffic control collectively will add up more than the actual construction. So if we continue to have to operate within a single corridor that's already active and keep widening it and changing it, as opposed to building some roads where we don't have quite so much traffic right now, I would argue that we will end up paying a lot more under that scenario.
Senator Egan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll wait till Mr. Robinson's complete.
Okay.
I just have a final comment.
Any more questions?
No, I think that was it. It was pretty much looking at that. You do have some specific projects which are dramatically less, but everybody has the letters now so they can at least make their own minds up. Thank you.
Okay. With that, thank you, Mr. Otteson. Ms. Riddell, she's still in here or she run off? Come on up here and show us your smiley face and tell us what we have here. I see you're here to respond to questions, so if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Revenue.
Could you help the committee with the financial exposure we possibly are facing here, and what is this issue that's we're looking at?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I think You know, the state is in a unique opportunity to make some serious investments into major projects. And while it's important to understand this project in and of itself, I think from a financing perspective, it's important that we consider all the projects that are on the table. And while the moral obligation may not require additional funding down the road, and the $150 million is all that is needed, I can tell you that outsiders will be looking at the overall financial picture and how we're making all the investments and how we're committing the state's finances on a global basis to grow the state.
So this off-balance sheet financing mechanism will potentially have some impact? Is that, am I hearing you correctly? That's what you're saying?
I believe it will have impact. It may be positive impact. But quite honestly, it's going to be looked at in the entire picture of the state's overall fiscal health. So to the extent that we have an unfunded pension liability or we've made additional commitments, whether it's to a gas line or to a hydroelectric facility in Susitna, they're going to add up all of those commitments and look, and they'll give us credit for collecting the tolls, but and receiving some revenue off of it, and the economic growth that occurs because of various projects. But it could, so it could have a positive impact, but it'll have an impact, I believe.
Has the department looked at this financial model and done any stress testing and have any feel for what exposure we have?
We have not done any stress testing ourselves. We have looked at some of the stress tests that have been done by Kubota, and we do have concerns about some of the revenue forecasts and making sure that we understand fully what the full impact will be if there's a bridge and no one shows up to pay a toll is really what we want to understand.
We have other questions for Deputy Commissioner. Senator Thomas.
Just one, I guess, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that's regarding the letter I wrote last year as well to the Department of Revenue. Regarding that, I think everybody has that letter dated March 8, 2011 from the Commissioner, Department of Revenue. If, in fact, that still is the, after having maybe a year to take a look at the project and think about it, if, in fact, you still have the same opinion regarding moral obligation and or who the assets would actually belong to and whose responsibility that is at this point in time.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, we do still agree with the statements in the letter. I do think it's important to note that this bridge will belong to the state of Alaska from day one. It will never belong to the independent third party that's building it. It will belong to us, but we stand by our letter from March of 2011.
Thank you.
Any questions for the Department of Revenue? Okay, thank you for coming forward. Mr. Stark, where's he hiding at? Right in the front row with enthusiasm. He jumps forward to introduce himself and who he represents.
I do. My name is Jeff Stark. I'm a Chief Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska. I had indicated that I was here to answer questions if the committee had any, but I did not have any prepared testimony.
Right. The concern I have and questions I have is what exposure does the state have in crafting these mechanisms that maybe on the surface appears to have little exposure to the state? I'm not so sure that that is in fact accurate.
Well, it's generally is accurate that the state would be largely protected. If assuming Kubota goes through with the procurement process that it is currently in the middle of, it will award a contract to one of the three shortlisted developers, enter into what's called a public-private agreement, or PPA, that is currently being drafted by outside counsel. It is a tremendously complex document. When you add in all the technical provisions, it's somewhere in the 800 to 1,000-page range. But it is the most comprehensive legal document I've certainly ever seen. It will govern the relationship of the parties over roughly a 40-year period roughly 5 years in construction and then 35 years during the operation. And it is a tremendously tightly drafted document and takes care of as many contingencies as humanly possible to anticipate. The basic structure of the agreement is as has been described to you. The developer will be obligated for design, build, finance, operate, and maintain. So they will have most but not all of the cost risks. Mr. Livingstone mentioned the geotechnical issue, the issue of what if the soils are different than what we currently anticipate. That is an issue that is being looked at very carefully at the moment. It is one of the larger risks that is currently under consideration, I guess, in terms of how it will be treated in the PPA. But the way it will be treated will be some sort of a shared risk between the state and the developer in the end, although we don't know quite how that's going to come out. There are some other cost risks that the state will bear. One of the big ones, one of the more obvious ones, would be seismic risk in terms of if there were a large earthquake. The design criteria will require the bridge to be built to very stringent specifications in terms of withstanding an earthquake. But there is some possibility. At some point, it makes no sense from a financial standpoint. I mean, if you try to make the thing totally bomb-proof, you spend so much in the construction costs that it becomes unaffordable. So there is, I think, a very minimal risk in terms of seismic risk to the state or to Kibata, but there is that possibility. But that's a great example of the sort of risk that this Kibata and the state really should take on, because if there is a earthquake of the magnitude that would cause damage to the bridge, the Anchorage area would almost certainly be a disaster area, and the FHWA, Federal Highways Administration, would step in with financial support in that sort of a situation. The developer will also be required to carry earthquake insurance that will cover that sort of a situation.
How about a cost overrun exposure?
Cost overrun exposure, again, unless you come into one of these specific events, those will be borne entirely by the developer. So there will be specific issues that could cause at least a portion of the risk to be shifted to the state. Geotech, seismic, finding unexploded ordnance, I know, is one of them. Hazardous materials, there are some areas in the route where there are already known or suspected, and the developer will be expected to deal with those areas at its own risk. But if hazardous materials were found somewhere else, that would again be a shared risk between the state. But other than a limited number of identified risks, the developer will have all of the cost risks. And if they just underbid it, then they're going to bear that risk, and they're going to have to pay.
We have any question for Mr. Stark? And we are out of time, unfortunately. Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final comment, if I may, and it doesn't involve the AG's office. I just appreciate Mr. Foster and his group promoting Kibata, and it's just a suggestion from me and some other people from Southeast Alaska. You have a nice brochure promoting Kibata, and on the last page of your promotional brochure it says, "This is what you'll see as you drive back to Anchorage from your day of business with the legislature at the Capitol in Willow." That offends me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This meeting adjourned.